Welcome back to VLND Rounds. In the previous episodes, we've been talking about body composition, and I focused on fat as well as muscle. In this episode, I will be addressing another component of body composition, which is bone. Let's go. In the medical setting, adult medical setting especially, I find that bone really doesn't come up very much. It's not very much considered, except in a very specific context, right? When we're addressing a patient population of a certain age, the elderly population, or maybe when you have a patient who is a postmenopausal woman. Aside from that, we really don't discuss bone at all. And I find this is true not only of medical providers, but I think patients have this mindset as well. So if you're young, you probably don't think very much about your bones and you take for granted that, you know, they're generally healthy and you probably don't have to worry till you're older. The reason for this, I think, is that we're mostly focused on the structural aspects of bone, right? That bone is responsible for giving us a frame, our skeleton. It helps us maintain a posture, and it helps us with movement. So that's really what people think of when they think about their bones, when they think about their skeleton. But there are so many other things that bone is involved in. For example, bone is involved in your metabolism, in energy regulation. Bone is also involved in your immune system. And so those aspects of bone are rarely ever discussed in a medical setting. Today I'll be talking about the conventional structural aspects of bone, but I hope to also go into those other elements that we don't talk about very often. Well, let's start by going back to body composition. If you remember, when we look at body composition by DEXA, then we're looking at fat mass and its various compartments, right? You're going to look at fat in the subcutaneous tissue and also fat in the visceral compartment. Then we have this category of lean mass. And under lean mass, I told you, we essentially have muscle, bone, water, organs, and tissue. So bone is included in there. Now, when you do have someone that is, let's say, postmenopausal or elderly, then the medical provider is likely to send them for a bone density test. This is actually done by the same machine that gives you your body composition. So the DEXA was actually invented to assess bone, specifically the bone mineral content. And then they found that we could actually use it to assess body composition as well. Very few people use it for that that reason, but you know, you could do it for both. So the more well-known aspects of the DEXA scan is for bone mineral density. Let's look a little at the structure of bone and how it's formed. So the main bone cells are osteoblasts, osteocytes, and osteoclasts. Osteo for bone, blasts, B-L-A-S-T-S, cytes, C-Y-T-E-S, and then class, C-L-A-S-T-S. If we start with osteoblasts, we can think of them as the cells that form or make bone. They play a role also in bone remodeling in an indirect way, but primarily when people talk about osteoblasts, they're thinking about making bone with these cells. The way they do it is they lay down a matrix that is made up of protein, and this matrix is called osteoid. The proteins in there, 90% of the proteins in that osteoid would be collagen, primarily type 1 collagen, right? And that's the first part of making bone. After that, osteoblasts also help with the mineralization process of making bone. And by this, we mean that we're laying down mineral crystals, particularly calcium phosphate. And these crystals are called hydroxyapatite. So the osteoblasts now help to lay down these hydroxyapatite crystals in that protein matrix that is called osteoid. They do it so well that they get into a little bit of a bind, because as they're laying down the mineral content around them, they're kind of essentially trapping themselves in this now hard matrix. Because once you have that calcium phosphate crystal substance laid down in the bone, that's what makes the bone hard, because the protein matrix is actually soft. If you've ever lived in an area where you have hard water and you have the calcium carbonate, you notice that it's pretty hard to get rid of, you know, in your kettles and maybe in your faucets. So this is similar with bone. We have a different salt. We have calcium phosphate, but that's what gives bone its hardness and its strength, right? So here are these osteoblasts, and they're happily making the osteoid and then laying down the, helping to lay down the minerals in the osteoid. And then what happens is they get trapped in there, and they get trapped in a little hole called a lacuna. Now, luckily, just before they get completely trapped, they kind of extend themselves out. So they have these little arms that extend outwards, right? And as they extend outwards, those are areas where they don't lay down any minerals. Now, when they become trapped in this little lacuna or this little hole, then actually the osteoblasts themselves have a transformation, and they become osteocytes. Osteocytes are really the main cells in bone. So they make up 90 to 95% of bone cells. And as I said, they come from osteoblasts, and they are now kind of trapped in this mineral matrix. However, if you remember that they extended their arms right before they finally sealed themselves up with the hydroxyapatite, those arms are really traveling in canals that we call canaliculi. And they extend outwards towards other osteocytes in their own little foxholes. Right. So that's a good way for these osteocytes to be able to communicate with each other so that they're not just locked in their own little lacuna. Also traveling in those canals, the canaliculi, would be blood vessels that would bring, you know, blood supply, oxygen, and nutrients to those cells, because those are living cells and they all need oxygen and nutrients. Right? So it's very important that they have these canaliculi. Now, the third type of cells that we see in bone are called osteoclasts, and they are really formed from a type of immune cell. They're kind of odd looking. They're very big. And if you ever look at diagrams of them, they look a little bit like Pac-Man. They're really involved in bone resorption, or the breaking down of bone. And what happens is they really secrete these substances that dissolve bone, and therefore they are involved in bone remodeling. Because bone is not a static substance. We tend to think of our skeleton as static, and once it's formed and it doesn't really change. And that's not true. Bone is always constantly being remodeled. It's constantly being formed and then broken down in the body. So it's really very active and dynamic. And so the osteoblasts form the bones. They also indirectly secrete substances that control the formation of osteoclasts. And then the osteoclasts are the ones that actually break down the bone. We talk a lot in the medical world about osteoporosis. Now, in the past, that just used to be, you know, defined as low bone mass. But nowadays, as with fat, as with muscle, besides the mass of the tissue, we're also concerned about the quality of the tissue. So in this case, we're concerned about bone mass, but we're also concerned about the quality of the bone, how strong it is. And the reason we care is that osteoporosis is associated with a risk for fractures. Now, when you think about it, fractures, you know, in the context of other diseases like cancer, maybe autoimmune diseases, they seem rather boring and just unglamorous. But, you know, they really have great significance and can impact our health greatly. Osteoporotic fractures are fractures that are seen in the spine, in the hips, and also the forearm wrist area. Okay, those are the main areas where we see osteoporotic fractures, and these fractures occur with minimal trauma. So obviously, if you fall from the roof, you're going to break something. You're going to break a lot of things. And, you know, those would not be considered osteoporotic fractures because you're just falling from a great height and there's great impact, right? And that's going to cause breakage of bone. But when we have minimal trauma, so what do I mean by that? So you say you're just walking along and you trip on something and you fall from your standing height. Normally when you fall, you might get a bruise or two, but you really shouldn't be breaking any bones, particularly bones in your spine, in your hip, or forearm wrists, okay? But if you do, then those would be considered osteoporotic fractures. That would be minimal trauma. There are other areas that, you know, could have osteoporotic fractures, like the ribs, the sternum, the clavicle. If you, for example, had a facial fracture or a skull fracture, or maybe you had some broken bones in your hands, those are generally not considered osteoporotic fractures. So here we're talking about spine, hip, wrist, forearm, all right? And those are the areas that we assess for bone mineral density when we do the DEXA. We're not really looking at the whole body. We're specifically looking at the spine, in the hips, and also the wrist and forearm. The problem with these osteoporotic fractures is that they tend to be completely asymptomatic until you actually get the fracture, right? So you don't notice that you have osteoporosis. You are mostly unaware. And then, boom, one day you trip fall or you bump into something and suddenly, you know, you get a fracture. So there's no warning signs, and that's what makes it really difficult to address. In the U.S., the prevalence of osteoporosis for people 50 years and older, in 2007-2008, it was 9.4% for the general, for men and women. For women, it was 14%. 10 years later, 2017 to 2018, the U.S. prevalence was 12.6%, and in women, in particular, it was almost 20%. So it's gone up. The International Osteoporosis Foundation notes that there are 8.9 million fractures per year. And really, one in three women will get an osteoporotic fracture, one in five men. The combined lifetime risk of osteoporotic fractures is 40%. That's equivalent to your cardiovascular risk, right? In white women, the risk for breast cancer, you have one in nine women will get breast cancer, one in six will get a hip fracture, and the lifetime risk for prostate cancer in men is 11.3%, and 27% for fractures in those, you know, 50 years and over. For women over 45 years of age, they spend more days hospitalized for fractures than diabetes, heart attacks, and breast cancer, right? So this is not insignificant. In fact, in Europe, I think the total cost burden of all cancers are lower than osteoporotic fractures, except for lung cancer. So you can see that there's very high morbidity and mortality with fractures, with osteoporotic fractures, because that's also how people die, in case you didn't know. Generally, no matter how, you know, unhealthy they are, and they may have several chronic conditions going on, people just kind of get by, and then one day they have that fall and they break something, they break a hip. They go into the hospital, get that hip fixed, and then generally within the year, they decline and they die. Right? That's really how a lot of people die around the world. So it's really important to address osteoporosis and to prevent any fractures from occurring. Now, there are several risks for fractures, things that put you at high risk for fractures. This is not a complete risk list, but age, obviously, if you're older, then you'd be at higher risk. And sex, I just said that women actually have higher risk for fractures. Personal history of a fracture. If you've had a fracture in the past, then it's likely you will have another one. So it's really a bad sign to have that first osteoporotic fracture, right? Family history of fractures also could put you at risk for osteoporotic fractures. And then you have the usual things like smoking, alcohol use, also steroid use. So if you have someone that has had long-term use of steroids because of an autoimmune disease or for, you know, really bad asthma, for example, then you're at higher risk for fractures. And if you have lower bone mineral density, then generally that's been associated with higher risk for fractures. But we, in that category, when we're looking at bone mineral density, we do have to be careful because that's ethnicity dependent. So for example, in Chinese women, they have lower bone mineral density, and yet they have lower rates of fractures, both in the spine and also in the hips. And this is because even though they have less mineral content in the bone, the microstructure of the bone is different. And they also have different hip geometry, so that factors into their risk for hip fractures. For African American women, they have lower risk for fractures, but that risk tends to increase as they tend to have increasing chronic conditions. So you lower risk, but if you have more chronic conditions like diabetes and high blood pressure, then your risk will go up accordingly. And there is a big increase in the rates of fractures after 75 years of age. With Latina women, American Bone Health notes that Latina women have the highest risk for fracture when compared to Native American women, African and Asian American women. So, you know, we look at all the different factors, but we also have to think about the ethnicity and the prevalence of osteoporosis and fractures in those populations. What happens when you're diagnosed with either low bone mass or straight out osteoporosis? Generally, what I find is that practitioners will recommend the usual regimen of vitamin D and calcium, and that's about it. Vitamin D, calcium, and then, oh, it didn't help, so now we have to consider medications. That's the general trend that I have noticed. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about what factors are involved in making sure that you have good bone formation and maintenance. Okay, let's talk about calcium first. Now, calcium is really important in your body because, for example, for your muscles to function properly, you're going to need calcium. It's very important for cell signaling. So for cells to communicate with each other, they have to send signals, and calcium is really very important for cell signaling. It's very important in immune function as well. I told you that we tend to think of bone as mainly as a framework for the, for your body and for structure and for movement. But bone is also a storage organ for minerals, right? So calcium and phosphorus are stored in the bone. And when you need it, you could actually go to your bone, like going to the bank and withdrawing some calcium, right? What happens is if you suddenly have a drop in calcium levels, or you have low calcium levels, let's just say from poor nutrition, you're not getting enough calcium in your diet, then, you know, the blood levels of calcium drop. And as I said, this is not good because it's going to impact the function of your organs, of your muscles, right? All the cells in your body. And so this is very, very crucial that we regulate the levels of calcium in your blood. You have a gland called the parathyroid gland, or they're actually glands. You have four little ones. They sit behind your thyroid. Kind of look like little knobs that sit behind your thyroid gland. And they're called parathyroid because they're next to the thyroid. Yep. The parathyroid gland secretes a hormone called parathyroid hormone. And this hormone's job is to help regulate the levels of calcium in your blood. So let's just say we have, again, that situation where you have low calcium levels in the blood, and we detect that the parathyroid gland makes parathyroid hormone, and this parathyroid hormone does a number of things. So let's just consider in the kidney what it does. In the kidney, it says, gosh, we need that calcium, so we're going to reabsorb any calcium we can get from the urine. We don't want to waste any calcium in the urine. So let us just reabsorb as much of the calcium as possible. Also, calcium tends to bind to phosphorus, right? And we need free calcium, ionized calcium. That means it's not bound. We need free calcium so that they can enter into cells and do their function. They're bound to phosphorus. They're not available for use in the body, right? So we want to actually decrease the level of phosphorus in your blood, because that way we don't bind to whatever calcium is available. So in addition to reabsorbing as much calcium as possible, your parathyroid hormone is going to signal the kidneys to dump as much phosphorus as possible in the urine. So we're taking in calcium, we're dumping the phosphorus so that we have as much free calcium reabsorbed as possible. The other thing the parathyroid hormone will do is signal the bone. Remember I said this is kind of like the bank, you know, where your calcium and your phosphorus are deposited. So now that we need more calcium in the blood, we can go to the bank, and the parathyroid hormone signals the bone such that the osteoclasts, the cells that break down bone, now become active, and we get a lot more of those osteoclasts forming, and they proceed to break down those hydroxyapatite crystals, which I told you are made of calcium phosphorus. So if we break down the bone, we are releasing more calcium, right? Very smart. And this calcium then can go into the blood and replenish the levels in the blood. So the parathyroid hormone is very important in helping to maintain the calcium levels. The other thing that it does too is it helps with converting vitamin D into its active form in the kidneys. So vitamin D generally is formed in your skin when you are exposed to UVB from the sun. And then we have this inactive form of vitamin D that needs to be converted to an active form by a specific enzyme in the kidneys. And parathyroid hormone helps to do that. So once we convert the inactive form of vitamin D to the active form, then that vitamin D can also help the body absorb calcium in the diet. right? And that's really why when you're diagnosed with osteoporosis or you have low bone mass, your doctors will tell you to have your vitamin D and your calcium. Now, that's all well and good. And there have been studies that kind of say, well, it has a minimal effect, the vitamin D and calcium. It helps a little bit, doesn't help very much. But one thing I want to comment here is that the way we dose the vitamin D is really important if you're giving supplemental vitamin D, right? Before I get into dosing vitamin D, let's just talk about vitamin D and how it's formed naturally. As I said earlier, your skin converts cholesterol that's in the skin, right, into vitamin D when you're exposed to sunlight. So a lot of people think, well, I'll just go out in the sun and I should get enough vitamin D that way. However, it's really a specific component of sunlight that will do that conversion. And those would be the ultraviolet B lights, the UVB part of the spectrum. The problem is that if you're living at latitudes above 32, let's say 32, 35, in the northern or southern hemisphere, then really you're not going to get enough UVB, specifically during the winter months, right? And that's because of the way the angle of the sun hits the earth at those latitudes or beyond those latitudes, right? So the UVB exposure decreases as you go from 32 upwards, whether you're in the northern or southern hemisphere. And as I said, this depends on the season, it depends on time of day, weather conditions, ozone layers, and so forth. In the northeast of the US, and that's where I am, in New England, basically you're not going to get much vitamin, much UVB exposure most of the year. In the summertime, you probably can get some UVB around, let's say, 10 in the morning and maybe 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So there's a specific time range within which you can get some UVB exposure. But you have to be out there, and most of us, you know, if we're outside at those times in the summer months, you know, maybe your arms are exposed, or maybe you're wearing shorts and some of your legs would be exposed, right? But that's really not a lot of surface area for you to make a lot of vitamin D. And then in the winter, you're not really going to see much vitamin D made in the skin. And if you have darker pigmentation, it's even harder for you to get enough UVB to make your own vitamin D. In fact, most young, healthy blacks do not achieve optimal levels of vitamin D at any time of the year. Okay. And vitamin D deficiency is also high even in Africa and in India. These are countries where you think you get a lot of sunlight, and so probably people are not vitamin D deficient, but that's not true. They actually have high rates of vitamin D deficiency as well. And when we look at different ethnicities, nearly 2/3 of Native Americans are vitamin D deficient, and 1/3 of them have severe deficiency. About 30% almost of Hispanic Americans have vitamin D deficiency, and 50% of Asian Americans are D deficient. I grew up in the tropics, and no one wanted to be out in the sun. And, you know, most people would use their sunscreens and sunblocks. So even though I lived in a place where there was sunshine all year round, a lot of people were also vitamin D deficient. So if you're not getting enough vitamin D from the sun, then you would need to take supplemental vitamin D. Now, first thing to remember is that vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin. So it would be helpful to consume that with some fats in your meal. So if you're on a no-fat meal plan, then you probably won't get a lot of the fat-soluble vitamins absorbed. The other thing that I think people don't realize is that the vitamin D receptor is an intracellular receptor. It's not on the surface of the cell membrane in your cells. It's inside the cell. And it is actually paired with the vitamin A receptor. I don't want to go into the technical aspects of that. But it really means that optimally, you really want to make sure you give vitamin D together with vitamin A, because the receptors work together. They're paired. They're heterodimerized together inside the cell. And when that vitamin D is bound to its receptor inside the cell, then we can control transcription of genes in the nucleus. And that's why vitamin D is important in overall metabolism. We consider it a pro-hormone because it has its effects over your entire body. So make sure that if you're taking your vitamin D, besides having it with some fats in your meal, that you are also supplementing with enough vitamin A, and that is not beta-carotene. Please, that is not beta-carotene. Okay, because sometimes I hear people say, oh yeah, I gave my patient vitamin A, and you look at that's beta-carotene. That's a precursor molecule to vitamin A, which is retinoic acid, right? And the problem with giving a precursor molecule is that the conversion from beta-carotene to retinoic acid is very, very unpredictable. You can't tell how much each individual is going to convert. It may be absolutely nothing. It may be a little bit. You have no clue. Maybe 30% in some people, maybe 3% in some people of that beta carotene will be converted to vitamin A. So there's no way to know. And that's why if we're talking about giving someone vitamin A, you really should consider giving the active bioavailable form, right? So that beta carotene isn't going to cut it. In addition, beta-carotene, old study, but, you know, it's been associated with lung cancer in smokers. So if I have a smoker, I would never want to put them on beta-carotene. Okay, I said that calcium and phosphorus are minerals that are stored in bone. There's another mineral that is stored in bone, and that is magnesium. And magnesium is involved in over 600 biochemical reactions in your body. So it's very, very important. And we can get magnesium in our diet through green leafy vegetables primarily, although if you cook them, you know, that will decrease some of the magnesium levels. So having lots of green leafy vegetables would help you get enough magnesium. However, we still have a lot of people who are deficient in terms of their intake of magnesium, primarily lactating women and women who are pregnant. So with magnesium deficiency, you're going to have some direct and indirect effects on bone. So direct effects would be that it's going to affect those hydroxyapatite crystals and how they align in the bone. And if you have magnesium deficiency, then that alignment of the hydroxyapatite crystals will be off. And this is going to affect the quality, the microstructure of the bone, and therefore the bone strength. The other thing that magnesium deficiency will do is that it will decrease the number of osteoblasts and will actually increase more osteoclasts in the bone. And remember that the osteoclasts are actually breaking down the bone. So you have less cells that are making bone, and now you have more cells that are breaking down bone. So the net effect is going to be more bone breakdown. We have some indirect effects as well, because it will also decrease parathyroid hormone. And as a result, you have that decreased vitamin D, right? Because parathyroid hormone helps convert vitamin D into its active form. So you have less vitamin D and therefore less calcium absorption. And also when you have decreased levels of magnesium, you will have more oxidative stress and also inflammation, which is going to increase the breakdown of bone. One other thing is that magnesium is really important in the health of your blood vessels as well. And if you have a poor blood supply to the bone, then that's going to impact the mass as well as the quality of the bone, right? So let's talk about this. We have, remember, the osteocytes now that are trapped in the bone matrix, the hard hydroxyapatite matrix that's laid around them. But they have extended these arms that will help them communicate with other osteocytes in their own little holes. And there are blood vessels and nerves running through those little canals as well, so that we get oxygen and nutrients to the osteocytes. We have a central canal that is called the Haversian canal. And this is where the main blood supply will come in and then branch off to these little canals between the osteocytes. And it's really important then that we have good blood supply to the bone for the bone to be healthy. Your cardiac output is really the amount of blood that's pumped around your body within a minute. And that is about 5, maybe 6 liters per minute. And 10% of your cardiac output is actually going to bone, right? And so we have to really nourish the bone with a good blood supply. What happens if that blood supply is compromised because those blood vessels are unhealthy? That's a condition called endothelial dysfunction. If you have low magnesium, that's one way you can have endothelial dysfunction. But you can have also increased inflammation in your body, and that will increase endothelial dysfunction as well. So this is compromising blood flow to the bone. And as a result, your bone is not going to get enough oxygen. It's not going to get enough nutrients. And that's going to impact the health of the bone. All right, so let's think this through. We need that matrix, that protein matrix, right? Mostly collagen protein, right? For bone to be formed. All right, and collagen specifically, it needs vitamin C to be formed properly, because we have these specific amino acids which make up collagen, and they have to be cross-linked, and they can only do that with enough vitamin C. So we have to make sure that if we're going to have good bone, first of all, we have to have enough protein, right? And then we have to have vitamin C to cross-link the collagen. And that shouldn't be a problem because you eat your oranges, right? Except that 40% of Americans are below the estimated average requirement of vitamin C. Okay, and I certainly have seen scurvy in my patient population. Yes, complete with corkscrew hairs and bleeding gums, all of that. And many, many patients with very low levels of vitamin C. The half-life of vitamin C is actually only 6 hours. So it can't be stored in your body. So you have to have a good supply. And if you have a lot of inflammation, right, it's an antioxidant, you might actually need more vitamin C. So we have to consider that in the diet as well. So we need enough protein, and we have to have that vitamin C as well. And then, of course, we have to have the vitamin D. And if you're going to supplement the D, you want to give it with bioactive A, vitamin A. And I also usually dose with K2 as well. I'm not going to get into that in this episode. If you want, I can talk about vitamin K2 in another episode. That's menaquinone, not phylloquinone. Different from K1. Okay, so that's for supplementation. And then we also have to give magnesium. Okay. And generally, when I have seen practitioners give magnesium, they are going to give it in the form of magnesium oxide. So if you do have a practitioner who might even consider magnesium, a lot of times they will write you a script for magnesium oxide, which is great if you have constipation, because magnesium oxide is a great purgative, which is a very nice way of saying it's going to make you have diarrhea. And if you look at the main ingredients of milk of magnesia, that's a nice healthy dose of magnesium oxide. So we'll fill up your sewage system with magnesium, but I don't know how much is getting into your body. So you really want to make sure if you're going to supplement with magnesium, and if you are looking to have healthy bones, you might consider that, especially if you don't have enough intake of green leafy vegetables. Then you want to make sure you have an absorbable form. Magnesium citrate, I like to use magnesium glycinate, a chelated form of magnesium. All right, so, you know, when have you heard your health practitioners tell you, oh, you know what, you have poor bone mass and poor bone quality, and we really should prioritize taking care of that? When have you heard them say, on top of vitamin D, which should be taken properly and taken with vitamin A, maybe K2, and also enough protein and enough vitamin C and magnesium in an absorbable form, you know, we will, you know, hopefully get your bone in a better place. Now, we generally just throw the vitamin D, and it's very small amounts, minute amounts of vitamin D, spittle amounts of vitamin D, some calcium, call it a day, and say, didn't work. Moving on. Let's go to medications, right? I'm not against medication at all. I do use them. I do believe in the judicious use of medication. But I feel we go to it too quickly and we ignore other aspects of our health. And we really should consider all those things, especially nutrition in this case, before we jump to medications all at once, right? One other thing that is really important would be weight-bearing exercise. So we know that mechanical loading is really good to help maintain the health of bone. And if you have good mechanical load to your bones, then you're going to stimulate bone formation. You don't have to, you know, really be lifting very heavy weights. Just weight-bearing exercise would be a good start. So walking and, you know, doing your activities, being very active during the day. It would be great if you added resistance training to that as well. But, you know, we all have to start somewhere. So if you're not very active to begin with, you just want to start with increasing your activity, because that will be a great help to forming more bone. In fact, the less active you are, the more sedentary you are, the worse it is, not only for muscle mass, but also for bone. Okay, so we dealt with the structural aspects of bone. Now I want to move on to the immune aspects of bone. Again, this is not really considered in a medical setting, but all your immune cells, really most of them, are born in your bone, right? That's your bone marrow, which you've heard of, and that's where your immune cells are formed. And so if you had no bone marrow, then you would have no immune cells, and that would be really, really bad. Okay. So directly, just by thinking of that, you realize that, all right, if I had no healthy bones, then that's going to impact my immune health. We have immune cells like lymphocytes and macrophages that regulate the immune bone crosstalk. So they're constantly sending signals to the bone, and they're receiving signals from bone. And there's this immune crosstalk between the two. By the way, remember I said the osteoclasts are actually immune cells? They are formed from macrophages, a type of immune cell, which I find particularly interesting. And there's a talk that I gave, a general overview on macrophages. If you're interested, we'll put the link below, and you can click on that and watch that presentation. I won't talk about them specifically right now, but they are a very interesting class of immune cells. And osteoclasts are a specific category of the macrophages. many immune signals regulate their formation and their function. So things like interleukin-1, interleukin-6, and tumor necrosis factor alpha, right? These are all immune signals that are important in inflammation, but they also regulate osteoclast formation and function. Now, we have the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system. I'll probably do an episode on inflammation and the immune system if you want. Let me know in the comments. But let's talk about lymphocytes, which are a type of a category of immune cells, and they're part of the adaptive immune system. So we have, amongst lymphocytes, we have T cells and we have B cells. The T cells are really important for bone remodeling. We know that if we have resting or quiescent T cells, then that has a bone protective effect, so that there's less breaking down of bone, less bone resorption, and you also have lower osteoclast numbers when you have quiet T cells. However, when you rev up the T cells and you increase their activity, you activate them, and this happens with infection or inflammation, then you stimulate osteoclast formation, and as a result, you're going to prime more bone breakdown. So inflammation, autoimmune disease, cancer, things like that can activate T cells, and we see bone loss associated with these conditions. B cells are also lymphocytes, and they make antibodies, right? And they're similar to T cells in that when you have activated B cells that you see in inflammatory diseases, then we have bone changes as a result. So B cell formation, for example, is going to increase when you have estrogen deficiency, right? And this may be the reason for bone loss when you've removed the ovaries in a patient. And if you give estrogen to those patients, we actually see that the B cell formation drops, but they actually make more immunoglobulins. Their function improves. Okay? So there's a link there between hormone status, the bone mass, and those B cell activities. In addition, these immature B cells are very interesting. Some of them have certain markers, and those specific B cells can actually differentiate along the pathway of osteoclast and eventually become osteoclast, the cells that are responsible for breaking down bone. Very interesting there. So, you know, just a general overview, it's fairly new topic, immune signaling in bone and how that impacts bone, but I think we really need to pay more attention to that aspect. We also have the hormonal function of bone. And again, we don't consider that bone secretes hormones like FGF23 and osteopontin and osteocalcin and bone morphogenetic proteins, right? These are all hormones that are secreted by bone and impact the function of different organs in your body, and they impact metabolism as well. Right now, I am just going to focus on one of these hormones, just to illustrate how important bone is. I mean, it has many substances and hormones that it secretes. I'll just focus on one, and that would be osteocalcin. So I found this paper really interesting. It's from Cell Metabolism 2019, Berger et al. And basically, they're addressing the acute stress response. This is your fight or flight response. So imagine you see a saber-toothed tiger. You're either going to, you know, try to fight it or run. I highly recommend running. That's up to you. So, you know, either way, you're going to need some energy to do that. You're going to need your muscles to be primed up. You're going to need extra blood flow, right? So your brain sends a signal to your adrenal glands, which sit on top of your kidneys. And the adrenals will now secrete adrenaline, norepinephrine, cortisol. These are stress hormones to help you in this situation. We want to increase your heart rate, increase your blood pressure, right? So that adrenaline is going to do that. You get better blood flow to your muscles so you can fight better or run better, right? And at the same time, it's also going to, the adrenaline is also going to have your fat release some fatty acids for fuel, because you're going to need energy to either fight or run, right? And it would be handy if we can break down some fat right now, because we sure could use the energy. Cortisol is also a stress hormone. It can help increase glucose levels in your blood, for example, and that would also fuel the, you know, stress response, so you can fight better or run better, right? What has puzzled scientists really is that cortisol is secreted during the acute stress response, but its physiologic effect actually takes hours to manifest, so it doesn't really kind of have its effects immediately. So they've been wondering if there's another hormone that may be involved in the acute stress response. And it turns out that they notice in mice that when the mice are stressed, they have a doubling almost, they have increase, huge increase in osteocalcin levels. Osteocalcin is a peptide, it's a protein, a hormone that's secreted by your bone. And they notice that when you stress mice out, they make a lot more osteocalcin. And it turns out that in the case of the acute stress response, that fight or flight response, your osteoblasts are going to take in glutamate rapidly. Glutamate is a neurotransmitter. So your sympathetic nerves are firing, and there's glutamate as well. This neurotransmitter is taken up very quickly by osteoblasts, and then they secrete large amounts of osteocalcin. Osteocalcin will then inhibit your parasympathetic tone. So we have the autonomic nervous system. One arm is the sympathetic nervous system, which is your fight or flight system, right? It mounts that acute stress response that we've been talking about. But its counterpart is the parasympathetic nervous system, and that is essentially, you could think of it as the opposite. So it is the rest and digest system. So you have the, you know, rev it all up, fight or flight system, and then you have the let's chill out, rest and digest system, which is the parasympathetic nervous system. So osteocalcin has the effect of inhibiting the chill out system, the rest and digest system, so that we augment the response of the fight or flight system, the acute stress response. And that will help you deal, help the mice, but, you know, hopefully humans as well, deal with stress more. So in this case, if you're very stressed, you should be really nice to your bones. Okay? In addition, osteocalcin seems to have some anti-aging effects. So we've seen that with osteocalcin, it seems to make muscle work better, increase fertility, and also improve memory, right? These are all things that we're concerned with in terms of aging. And when you give osteocalcin, we notice that, you know, these things all improve. Oh, one more thing about that cell metabolism study was that when they had mice that had their adrenal glands removed, completely removed. So now we don't have adrenals secreting the adrenaline, secreting the cortisol and so forth. You could still mount an acute stress response, right? You almost doubled the level of osteocalcin in the blood, and you could still mount that response. So very important in dealing with stress. So I hope you can see that your bone isn't just for keeping you upright and helping you move. Those are important things, but has immune function, has very important endocrine functions as well. So one other thing I'd like to talk about here is When we talk about body composition, we tend to separate out the various components. So I talked about fat, and then I went on and talked about muscle, and then today I'm talking about bone. But really, I think what's missing is that we're not seeing it all as a functional unit. In other words, we really should be talking about fat, muscle, bone as a functional unit, right? Not just fat, not just bone, not fat, muscle, bone, fat, muscle, bone, fat, muscle, bone. Okay. First of all, these cells, the fat cells, the muscle cells, the bone cells, all arise from mesenchymal stem cells, which are in the stroma of the bone. So they're kind of born from the same type of cells, the mesenchymal stem cells, right? These cells also make cartilage as well. But fat cells, muscle cells, and bone cells all arise from mesenchymal stem cells. So they're kind of related to begin with, right? And we've noted that in people who have osteopenia, they have poor bone quality and mass, they tend to have also poor quality and mass of muscle as well. In fact, the European Working Group on Sarcopenia in Older People, I always have a hard time with that name, my God. They noted that 60% of recently diagnosed hip fracture cases were also associated with sarcopenia. So those two seem to go together. In fact, in my population of patients, if I see osteopenia, I'm generally going to find sarcopenia. If I see sarcopenia, I always look for and I generally find the osteopenia. So we have this term now, osteosarcopenia. So we link the low bone mass and quality to the low muscle mass and quality, right? And certainly, muscle and bone really do influence each other. There are substances in muscle that help bone to heal, for example. So for a long time, surgeons have been aware, if you have fractures that are really difficult to heal, if you, you know, do specific surgeries and you have a muscle graft that you wrap around the fracture, you really will help those fractures heal a lot quicker and better, right? So there's something about the muscle that's helping the fractures heal. And at the same time, we think that there are substances secreted by the bone that may help muscle develop better. So, you know, when you work out and you stress out your muscles and you load them mechanically, right, that stress is actually good for your muscles. It causes a little bit of inflammation, but that will stimulate some muscle growth. Well, you know, it has substances like prostaglandin E2 that will help in promoting muscle growth, but bone actually secretes a whole lot more prostaglandin E2, like 1,000 times more. And that could actually be important in influencing how muscles grow, right? Particularly at the insertion of muscle fibers at the periosteal surfaces, the surface part of the bone. So those two are tightly linked together. You've also heard me talk about sarcopenic obesity. So that in patients who have obesity, they also have sarcopenia, low muscle quality and mass, right? And I find that in most of my patients, when I assess them with body composition, that that is true. So now we're linking the fat and the muscle. And in reality, we should probably be considering osteosarcopenic obesity. Put all three together, fat, muscle, bone. Remember we talked about the bone marrow. When you're young, you have primarily red marrow, which is producing a lot of these immune cells. And as we age, like past the age of 7 or so, you start to replace that red marrow, right, that young marrow, with yellow marrow. And yellow marrow is essentially marrow that has fat in it. And in a normal adult, about 75% of your marrow is fat. Okay, that's normal. And we know that if you find increased yellow marrow, increased levels of fat in the marrow beyond the 75%, that is associated with sarcopenia and also poor bone mass, osteopenia as well, right? So there is a link. Now, obviously, if you're going to look at the marrow, you can't do that by DEXA. That's really by MRI, because in the DEXA, you can't see through the bone. But assessing the bone marrow and noticing increased infiltration of fat, you find associated increased osteopenia and also less muscle as well. So we again see, you know, hints that we should be thinking of this as one functional unit. Fat, muscle, bone, fat, muscle, bone, fat, muscle, bone. When you look at the quality of bone and muscle, right, which you should do, besides looking at mass, now we have to look at the quality of the tissue. You'll find that when you have poor muscle or when you have poor bone, you have more infiltration with fat. When you see poor quality bone, you have more fat infiltration. When you see poor quality muscle, you have fat infiltration. Eventually, that fat then, you know, becomes replaced by fibroblasts, okay, which are also cells that have a mesenchymal stem cell provenance, right? They originate from mesenchymal stem cells. So they're part of that family, right? So poor quality muscle, you see a lot of fat in it, and eventually it becomes fibrous and scarred. And we see that also in bone. So these are hints, as I said, that we should perhaps stop thinking of them as individual compartments and see it as a functional unit. And certainly, I hope our research is going to go that way as well, because if we want to improve, for example, muscle function or muscle mass, you shouldn't just consider or look at muscle alone. You have to consider the influence of bone and fat as well, the quality of bone, the quality of fat, and the same for bone, right? So fat, muscle, bone, fat, muscle, bone, fat, muscle, bone. Start thinking of it as a functional unit. All right, time for our wrap-up, finally, okay? We started by looking at bone in terms of its structural function, its use as a good framework for posture and movement in our body. We talked about osteoporosis and fractures, and then we went into what we need to do to optimize bone health, not just with vitamin D. You have to supplement it correctly with vitamin A as well, and fat in your diet. And then you also need to be having enough protein in your meals. Make sure you have good vitamin C as well, because it will help make that collagen that is 90% of your bone matrix, right? Of the protein part of your bone matrix. And we also have to give enough magnesium to make sure you have healthy bone. So there are a lot of things to consider to make sure you have healthy bone. Besides that component, the structural component of bone, we also have bone as important for your immune health, right? It's the birthplace of your immune cells, and there's a lot of crosstalk between the immune cells and bone, and they're constantly communicating and sending signals to each other, and we certainly need more research in that direction. We also have bone with endocrine function, so it's secreting peptides, hormones that impact metabolism and the functioning of your organs in different parts of your body. And then finally, I just wanted us to remember to consider fat, muscle, bone as a functional unit and not just think about them in their separate components. So when you're talking about body composition, it should always, especially for practitioners, always keep in mind fat, muscle, bone, fat, muscle, bone, fat, muscle, bone. Don't look at anything in isolation there. All right. I think that's it for today's episode. I hope you had fun. I certainly did in preparing it and presenting it today. That's it for VLMD Rounds today. Signing out, I am Dr. Vivian Lo, and I sing the body electric.